Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Lucy Pony in Washington.
And I'm also Michael Atit in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March the 2nd, 2015. President Kiir is in Addis for the peace talks, and his negotiator says even though obstacles remain, there will be a deal.
President Asalba has arrived this afternoon, and we're hoping the Prime Minister Chair of IGAD will bring them together tomorrow.
And UNICEF accuses a militia aligned with South Sudan forces of abducting children just last month.
Any subscriber from South Sudan going to Kenya, to Uganda or Rwanda will use the same SIM card from South Sudan for the communication.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
President Asalba has arrived this afternoon, and we're hoping the Prime Minister Chair of IGAD will bring them together tomorrow.
That was Seyoum Mesfin, the lead mediator at peace talks for South Sudan. President Salva Kiir's arrival at what Mesfin has called the last round of peace talks for South Sudan comes just days before the warring sides have been told to reach a final deal to end nearly 15 months of fighting. As John Tanza reports from Addis Ababa, all eyes are on Mr. Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar, who have until Thursday to sign a peace deal.
Ethiopian diplomat Seyoum Mesfin has been the lead mediator at the 13-month-old peace talks for South Sudan. He says IGAD expects to bring Mr. Kiir and Machar together for talks as early as tomorrow.
They will be asked to discuss only three issues. A, the structure of the government, particularly the top level, the president, first vice president, vice president, or the president, prime minister, and vice president. The second is the power-sharing ratios of the cabinet and the National Assembly. And the third one is the status of forces. Do they want one army during the transition, two armies and so on?
Delegates from the two warring parties have not agreed on many of the key issues highlighted by Seyoum, including how to share power during 13-month transitional period. IGAD says, in a power-sharing proposal signed by Mr. Kiir and Machar early last month, that the transitional government should be in place as of July 9th. South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makui says delegates for the warring parties have been meeting at committee levels for more than a week, trying to iron out lingering differences and pave way for a peace deal.
Today we have completed the presentation, and the mediators will thereafter sit and try to harmonize these variant positions and come up with a harmonized document that will now be the subject of agreement or disagreement in the near future.
IGAD mediators have been studying the proposal from the two sides, from civil society activists, faith-based groups, and representatives of former political detainees. IGAD will give a final peace document to Mr. Kiir and Machar in the next few days, and the two leaders are expected to sign the deal. The international community has warned both men that if no peace deal is reached, more sanctions will be imposed on South Sudanese leaders. The chief negotiator for Machar's group says there are still issues that are blocking the road to peace. Diu Matok Ding agrees that one of the critical issues that need to be resolved is the structure of the army during the transitional period. Matok says in its current form, South Sudan's army cannot protect the country's citizens.
Our position as opposition, that we must have to form amalgamated unit, which are going to be the basis of the nuclear army of South Sudan during the pre-transitional period. They will be tasked with the responsibility of protecting the BIPs, with protecting the population, with protecting the civilian.
The two parties have also not agreed on financial issues, including how to share South Sudan's wealth. Debate is still continuing about power sharing in the transitional government. The rebels say they want the same number of positions in government institutions as Mr. Kiir's side will have. Matok says the rebels are insisting on power sharing equally because they feel it is the only way to bring stability to South Sudan.
We are saying if the other political parties are going to take 10%, then the warring parties must have to share the 90, 40, 45, 45.
Makui says even though the two sides do not see eye to eye on everything, the government will go ahead and sign a final peace agreement with the rebels.
This is a normal thing in every negotiation. There could be hiccups, there could be ups and downs, but nevertheless, we are optimistic that peace is still within our reach and we can get peace at any time.
The hope in Addis Ababa is that a final peace deal will be signed this week and nearly 15 months of violence in South Sudan will come to an end. The fighting, which has been centered mainly in Jonglei, Upper Nile and Unity State, has displaced nearly 2 million people, claimed tens of thousands of lives, interrupted children's education and dramatically slowed development in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm John Tanza in Addis Ababa.
As President Kiir departed from Juba, the minister in the office of the president says South Sudanese should hope for the best results from Addis Ababa peace talks. Philip Thornaleu reports from VOA from Juba.
Minister Awan Gwalariag says despite what critics are saying, President Kiir's trip to Addis has come at just the right time. He says government negotiators have recently reported progress at the talks.
We are going optimistic, hoping that the other side will also be mindful of the lives and the properties of South Sudan so that we could reach a final settlement. We hope, and that's our prayer, all of us, that the peace should be coming back to our people and then we embark on the development.
Riak says President Kiir will participate in a summit that will be attended by IGAD heads of states. Riak says government delegates have provided him with thorough updates on the areas of agreement as well as the areas of disagreement with rebel negotiators.
We are going with the president to see what are the contentious issues that are not resolved, and the issues of agreement should be there. Issues that need the principals to participate and resolve them. This is why he's just going at this time.
The act declined to specify what has been agreed to or what are still the big obstacles to a lasting peace deal. Negotiations resumed in Addis last week after a three-week break for consultations. Members of faith-based and civic society groups say there hasn't been enough progress. The deadline to reach a deal is this Thursday. President Kiir's decision to stay in Juba until today also raised concerns among participants. Bariak says the president has been in regular communication with negotiators and is determined to resolve the conflict amicably.
Our people suffered a lot from the decades of its struggle, and it's time for us to serve them and give them the services. This is the really expectation that we feel we should owe to our people. And I want to encourage our people to stay optimistic and stay united so that we could all focus on bringing the normalcy and peace back home so that we do a lot of things in this young nation.
At least 10,000 people have been killed and roughly 2 million others forced away from their homes since the fighting began in December 2013. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations Children's Fund says it believes scores of children abducted by armed men in South Sudan last month are being used as child soldiers. John Bard, UNICEF Communication Officer for South Sudan, tells VOA's James Buddy, hundreds of children preparing for exams were forcefully recruited as soldiers by Shuluk militiamen who are aligned with South Sudan government forces, a claim President Salva Kiir's spokesman Ateny Wek Ateny strongly denies.
We have become aware that the number of children who were taken about 2 weeks ago is probably in the hundreds. The number has increased because we became aware through the course of the week that the evidence that children had been taken, more than 89, was overwhelming. Most of these children are not being held in one place. We can establish that, you know, some are in a training camp, some are still in the vicinity or actually in the village where they were taken. When you put together the evidence that we've received from various witnesses and also officials, UNICEF became deeply concerned that not only were there more than 89. I think we believe there's several hundred, but also we believe that many of them may be going off to fight in the very near future.
We have two factions that are fighting a civil war in South Sudan. Who does your organization believe may have taken these children?
We believe a militia group called the Johnson Ohlone Militia. It's a Shilluk militia. Took the children on February 15 and February 16. And the militia itself is aligned with the government forces, the SPLA.
Whoever is responsible, what are the possible consequences for that group?
One of the things that UNICEF and its partners are doing, both NGOs and also the UN, is that we are putting together a report for the Grave Violations of Child Rights Monitoring Report. This is an official report that will go back to the United Nations. And we are trying to verify the evidence that we have in order to make the report a lot stronger than it currently is. That's one of the reasons why a special mission went from Malakal, the capital of Upper Nile, where these children were taken, to Malut. And once the team was in Malut, they became very aware of the issue and the fact that these children had in fact been taken. So we are currently preparing that report, and it is a grave violation of child rights, and that will go back to the UN. And hopefully we are going to try and put some sort of pressure on all the factions who have children as soldiers to release them immediately. We believe that there's more than 12,000 child soldiers in South Sudan, and we want those kids out of the army, out of uniform and back in school.
The government spokesman, Atene Wek Atene, has said that the South Sudan government condemned the taking of children. Has this been communicated to UNICEF?
SPLA officials have told us repeatedly that they have no control over the internal workings of this militia, but they do acknowledge that the militia is aligned with the SPLA. And to our knowledge, what is happening up in the Upper Nile says to us that the SPLA itself, although reporting to us that it has no children in it, many of the children are found, in fact, on some of these militias that are aligned with the SPLA.
That's UNICEF Communication Officer for South Sudan, John Budd, speaking to James Batty from Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudanese no longer have to pay roaming charges in neighboring countries. We'll explain why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which do you enjoy more, radio or TV, and why?
I enjoy TV more because TV is audiovisual. I listen to the word and I see the pictures.
I enjoy radio more because radio has a lot of entertainment and a lot of information as regards to news.
I enjoy radio more because it is having access to vulnerable people. TV is so expensive, so mostly those people who are not having much wealth can't access it.
TV, because TV, when sometimes when they are reading news, when you look at things live, what is happening, I understand better.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. We've got good news if you're planning to travel to other East African nations. You no longer need to change your mobile phone SIM card to avoid steep roaming charges. On Friday, South Sudan became a member of one network area, a telecommunications initiative, which means regional calls are billed the same as local calls. Officials say it streamlines communication and reduces the cost of doing business for many South Sudanese. Mugume Davis-Rakarinj has more from Juba.
Juma Stephen Luga, the undersecretary in the Ministry of Telecommunications and Postal Services, says the One Network Area initiative will cut the cost of communication for all telecommunication networks operating in Juba, which include companies like Zain, Vivacell and MTN.
Any subscriber from South Sudan going to Kenya, to Uganda or Rwanda will use the same SIM card from South Sudan for the communication. And it will be one tariff, which is 10 cents. In our case, it will be 60 piastres. 60 piastres per minute.
The One Network Area project is one of the more important initiatives of the Northern Corridor Transit and Transport Coordination Authority, aimed at reducing the cost of doing regional business. The Northern Corridor links the landlocked countries of Uganda, Rwanda, South Sudan and Burundi to Kenya's maritime port of Mombasa. The transport corridor also serves Democratic Republic of Congo and Northern Tanzania. The initiative hopes to fast-track the implementation of development projects, including construction of the standard gauge railway, ICT infrastructure and oil refinery development. Stephen Luger believes the move will significantly boost trade and business in South Sudan.
The business group will benefit much because there are the people talking much and checking their goods coming or going to the other countries. So it will be also good for the business group to handle and also use their own network, you know. They can go to Uganda or to Kenya using South Sudan SIM cards. Also, business group from Kenya or from Uganda can come to do their businesses using their own SIM card. That is where we call it One Network Area.
And Luger says the One Network should also benefit expatriates working in South Sudan.
Low rate will allow subscribers to call their countries back without any fear that it will cost much. So actually, we say it is a breakthrough within the One Network Area.
Cell phone users in Juba are excited about the new developments. Eka John, a South Sudanese videographer, says the initiative has already started to have an impact.
I have one of my cousins in Nairobi and my younger sister in Kampala. Now they're all using the same thing. So I'm getting more calls from them than before now.
Monica Nasambu Sisungu, a Kenyan living in Juba, agrees. She says she goes weeks, even months, without calling her family because it was too expensive.
It's good that I can use my country's network. Sometimes I don't call because I feel I don't have enough airtime, so I just text.
So the initiative is not just good businesses. It may also help strengthen family bonds across the region. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Cameroon's military has killed several suspected Sudanese Janjaweed rebels who were poaching elephants in the national park. The militiamen have killed about 20 elephants during the past week and have been engaged in gun battles with security forces since invading the parks. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde. The rebels are believed to be selling elephant tusks to fund their activities.
Speaking after a visit to the Buba Jida National Park in northern Cameroon, Jean-Jacques Leboua of the Anti-Poaching Department of the Economic Community of Central African States said the rebels used sophisticated weapons, some of which are believed to have come from Libya after the war that destabilized the country. He said the militiamen use proceeds from ivory sales, especially in Asian countries, to fund their activities.
Illegal wildlife trafficking is considered to be the fourth, depending on how you count, the third or fourth biggest transnational criminal activity in the world, behind human trafficking, weapons trafficking, and drug trafficking. It is valued at between 8 and 10 billion U.S. dollars per year. When you're talking about this much money, you combine it with an illegal activity, you have corruption. Corruption at every single level of this chain, which begin and ends in East Asia, but which transits through Central Africa.
Researcher Thomas Ewing of the Washington-based C4ADS, an organization helping African countries uncover illicit networks of elephant poaching and illegal ivory trading, says many armed groups in Central African states are involved in wildlife crimes.
I can't tell you how much a terrorist group might make from ivory or if a given terrorist group engages in ivory trade, but I can say that a wide range of destabilizing actors in different African states seem to be engaged in this trade.
International wildlife organizations blame rebel groups for the slaughter of almost 12,000 elephants in Central African countries since 2004. They say the rebels are working with corrupt government officials to sell the ivory to Asia to finance their insurgencies. the government of Cameroon deployed its military to protect national parks in the north of the country after they lost nearly 2,000 elephants between 2012 and 2013. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Mo Ibrahim Foundation has awarded its multi-million dollar African Leadership Prize to the outgoing president of Namibia. VOA Gabe Joslow reports the prize, which aims to promote good governance, has also raised questions about whether African leaders need to be given a cash incentives to do their jobs.
The 2014 Ibrahim Prize for Achievement in African Leadership has been awarded to Namibian President Hifikepunye Pohamba, who is completing his second and final term in office this year. The chairperson of the prize committee, Salim Ahmed Salim, made the announcement at an event in Nairobi.
During the decade of President Pohamba's presidency, Namibia's reputation has been cemented as a well-governed, stable, and inclusive democracy, with the strong media freedom and respect for human rights.
The prize committee also recognized Mr. Pohamba's successful efforts to reduce the rates of HIV in his country, to extend free primary education to all of its citizens, and to promote gender equality in government. Mr. Pohamba has led Namibia since 2005. His successor is to be inaugurated later this month. The Namibian president is only the fifth recipient of the African Leadership Award and the first since former Cape Verde president Pedro Pires won in 2011. In the intervening years, the committee could find no other suitable candidates. The prize is the work of Mo Ibrahim, a Sudanese billionaire who made his money in mobile communications. Asked about whether it is right to give such a large cash prize to African leaders, given their reputation for wealth, Ibrahim said the purpose of the award is to draw greater attention to those humbler heads of state who are too often overlooked.
Even the winner today, how many of you heard about him before today? How many? Raise your hands. Look at you. Six people. Let us find our heroes and celebrate them. We have heroes in Africa. It's not only Mandela.
The foundation is also responsible for the Ibrahim Index of African Governance, which ranks countries based on factors including economic opportunity and human rights. The prize committee acknowledged Namibia, which ranks highly on the index, still faces challenges, including widening income inequality. Committee member Grasa Machel, the widow of former South African President Nelson Mandela, said these obstacles, shared by many countries in Africa, can also help distinguish good leadership.
And it's precisely because there are so many challenges that we have to recognize that despite the challenges, they were able to make progress. And that's the message which is being sent to all African leaders.
Mr. Pohamba will receive a $5 million prize plus $200,000 a year for the rest of his life. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
And on to health matters. A new report says sub-Saharan Africans rate their health and healthcare systems among the worst in the world. Nevertheless, improving health is not their top priority. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The report's been released as Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone continue to fight the Ebola outbreak, a situation that was made worse by the poor state of their health systems. Angus Deaton is co-author of the study.
I think most of us thought these episodes burnt out very quickly, and this one didn't, and I think that was surprising to a lot of people. But, and this is relevant for our work, healthcare systems in sub-Saharan Africa are very poorly organized and very badly done, and of course that certainly contributed to the difficulties of bringing it under control.
Deaton is Dwight D. Eisenhower, Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. It's important, he says, to understand what Africans list as their top priorities.
People in Africa don't think of health as their highest priority, at least for the government, whereas most aid agencies have been prioritizing health pretty heavily.
He summarizes the views of sub-Saharan Africans based on the findings of Gallup's annual World Polls.
They perceive their health pretty badly. They perceive their overall well-being pretty badly. Well-being is broader than just health. So, you know, many people sort of think, well, if you've lived in a poor country all your life, you're used to it by now, and you'd be just about as happy as everybody else. But if you ask people how their lives are going, sub-Saharan Africans rate those very poorly. So they know that life could be better.
Deaton says the same is true of their perceptions of health care.
Can you imagine a health care system that spends about $100 a year per person? That's not going to deliver very much health care.
So, if improving poor health care systems is not the top priority among Africans, what is?
If you ask them what government should be doing for them, they want money and jobs more than they want health, which is interesting. And I think it has something to do with the fact that there's a lot of morbidity and mortality in Africa.
During the early years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Africa, health workers say many infected people wanted food more than medical care. They knew the disease would take years to kill them, but a lack of food could do it much sooner. The findings show jobs are more important because they have an immediate effect on people's well-being.
Some countries, less than half of the population has ever had any contact whatsoever with a health professional. That's pretty amazing, and there's certainly differences in that across countries. So you get a country like Sudan or Somaliland, where it's less than half, and then you get places like Benin or Madagascar, where 90%, or Senegal, where more than 90% of the people have had some contact with the health system somewhere in their lives. So there's a huge amount of variability across Africa.
After an initial slow response to the West Africa Ebola outbreak, the international community poured in a lot of money and resources. Some observers say this will allow Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone not only to get better health care systems, but to maintain them. Deaton doubts this and says they could easily slip back to pre-Ebola conditions.
I don't think just very easily. I'd be stunned if it didn't happen. The fundamental problem is just incapacity of the state.
The Princeton professor says donors and aid agencies should take the study's findings seriously. They show that 31% chose jobs as their top priority, while 21% picked improving agriculture. Nearly 14.5% chose tackling corruption, while 13.5% decided on education and health care. Just over 6% chose electricity as the top priority. The study says those who chose jobs in agriculture shared an underlying factor: better livelihoods. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Monday. We leave you now with the song Ashewo by Azande Traditional Group. We've been listening to a Zande traditional song, Ashewo. I'm Michael Atit in Washington.
And I'm Lucy Pony in Washington. We're glad you could join us. Tune in again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.